So we're looking at that passage which I read just a second ago, Ruth chapter 1, verses 19 to 22. And if my sermon had a title this morning, it would be this: The Return of the Wanderer. The Return of the Wanderer. Naomi is the wanderer. She's been outside of her homeland of Israel for more than 10 years now, and she's been living in enemy territory in Moab. And last week, then, we saw Naomi beginning to return from Moab. She sets off on that long road with her two daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah. She eventually persuades Orpah to go back to Israel, but Ruth is unpersuaded. She's stubborn in her loyalties. She says, "Where you will go, I will go." And so together, then, Ruth and Naomi travel back to Naomi's hometown of Bethlehem. And in our passage, verses 19 to 22, finally they reached their destination. Naomi, the wanderer, returns. And this morning, then, I just want to look at this passage, and I want to begin by asking a basic question about this passage. I just want to ask, what do we make of this return? I mean, how should we feel about it when we read this passage? Should we be happy about what we see here? Should we be sad with what we see here? Should we be cross about what we see here? What lessons should we learn from this passage? What do we make of Naomi's return? That's my question. And to that question, then, I have three answers. And my first answer is this: we should be taught by her trouble. We should be taught by her trouble. And I suppose I want to begin by saying that of my three points this morning, this is the point which I am probably least enthusiastic about and most cautious about. You see, for some people, I'm sure this would be their main point, their only real point. And I don't want that to happen. I don't want you to hear the point I'm about to make and then sleep through my next two points. No, what I say in this point, I will soon be qualifying and mitigating in my next two points, because it's not the whole picture. But nevertheless, it's true, I think, to say that we should be taught by Naomi's trouble. And by that, I mean we should look upon her affliction, her trouble, the bad condition she's in when she arrives back in Bethlehem, and we should learn then why it's not a good idea to wander away from the people of God. Naomi, she stumbles back into Bethlehem looking very different to how she left it in the first place. Is this Naomi, the people ask in verse 19? They're sort of rubbing their eyes, thinking to themselves, is this the same woman? It looks like her, but she's definitely changed a little bit. And she has changed a bit, hasn't she? 10 years count for a lot in an ancient agrarian society. The sun does a lot to your skin in that time. But 10 years count for even more then when you add to the mix famine and stress and upheaval and grief, the death of her husband and then the death of her first son and then the death of her only remaining son. And with every new stress then, it's as if she looks less and less like the Naomi who left the village 10 years ago. And so it's no wonder then that when she speaks in verse 21, she says, I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. They'd looked like quite a strong company originally, setting out from Bethlehem those 10 years ago. Three men, one woman, perhaps servants and livestock, all of their belongings. They'd considered themselves full. And now, in our passage, this old lady returns. She's withered and she's drained by grief and regret and a sense of aimlessness. And what does she have to show for her travels in the land of Moab? Well, she has nothing to show, really, except for this Moabite accessory following her behind. Ruth, a foreigner, tagging along in the background, looking awkward, looking very much out of her comfort zone in this new land, looking more like an impediment, probably, than a blessing to Naomi. She is the fruit of Naomi's travels. It hardly compares then with her husband and the two strapping lads that she left Bethlehem with all of those years ago. And so what then do we learn from this? What lessons am I trying to draw out of this picture of Naomi? Well, this simple lesson, and it's a cautious lesson, but I just want to suggest that it probably wasn't wise for Elimelech and Naomi to have left Israel in the first place. And I am cautious about saying that, and I'm cautious because, as I said in my first sermon, it's not as if the book of Ruth really clearly condemns Elimelech's decision in the first instance. And also because, as we said in that first sermon, you know, in the book of Genesis, we see that other people did the same thing. Abraham and Isaac also went to foreign lands at times of famine, and they weren't condemned for that. Actually, they were blessed by doing that. And that fact is not without significance when we look at the book of Ruth. But nevertheless, I still think when we see Naomi returning from Moab looking troubled and impoverished and empty, and making that statement, I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. I think that fact alone does suggest to us that leaving Israel and going to Moab in the first place was not a wise decision. And going back to Abraham and Isaac, I mean, what they did was different to what Naomi did. You know, they were nomads, weren't they? They didn't have a land. Elimelech and Naomi, they did have a homeland. The soil that was under their feet when they were living in Bethlehem. The people around them, the various institutions that they were part of, the priesthood and the prophets and everything that was around them, the laws which governed them, all of these things were the Lord's gifts to his people. They were gifts that should have been treasured. You know, provided that those laws had been correctly implemented in Israel, provided that God's word was cherished and obeyed and the institutions had been enjoyed, provided all that had happened, and obviously during the time of the judges, that doesn't seem to be happening very much, but provided that that had happened, Israel would have been the nearest thing to heaven on earth. This was a land of blessing, it was supposed to be. And yet, Elimelech and Naomi, they leave this land and they settle instead in the land of Moab. They trade in the blessings of Israel for Moab. And regardless then of how bad Israel had become, at the end of the day, the land that they were moving to was far worse. Moab knew nothing of God's law and God's institutions. Moab had no true tabernacle. Moab had no true priesthood to atone for the people. Moab had no true prophets to declare the word of God. Moab had no true God. And yet Elimelech and Naomi, they move there. And perhaps they only intended to be there for a few weeks or a few months until the famine had disappeared. But somehow it's as if they get stuck there and 10 whole years pass and they're living outside of the land of Israel. And finally then, Naomi, in this passage, she returns, but when she does return, she feels empty. She feels impoverished. And you can't help then but quietly wonder to yourself, well, Naomi, what did you expect to happen when you left God's land and left God's people? And so, this is my first point. We should be taught by her trouble. And what should we be taught? Well, we should be taught that wandering from God's people doesn't do you any good. Some Christians decide, don't they, that for a season of their lives, it might be a good idea to take a break from church, to take a break from meeting with God's people. I'm not talking about people who are unwell or infirm or housebound or anything like that. There are plenty of people who have good reasons. They can't be here on a Sunday. But I'm talking about Christians who are perfectly capable of coming to church, but for whatever reason, they decide not to. Perhaps they've become disillusioned with the church. Perhaps there have been fights and squabbles in the church. And for them, then, the whole atmosphere of church has just become toxic. It's become socially overwhelming for them to be there. And so they make the decision that it's just best that for a bit I'm going to take a break and I'm going to spend my Sundays at home listening to whoever it might be on the internet. Perhaps they've become overwhelmed with work in their week. There are too many deadlines to meet. Their timetables just become too crowded. And they feel like, well, I can't afford to take a day off at this time. And so just for this especially busy season, I'm going to forget about church for a bit. I'm going to stay at home. I'm going to do my work. And then once that's passed, I'm going to come back. Or perhaps people have just lost their appetite for coming to church. There's just nothing to positively draw them. You know, it's as if one Sunday morning they wake up and they look at the clock, they realise they've slept in a little bit, and for the first time then their warm bed just looks a bit too comfortable to justify getting up and going to church. And then the same thing happens the next Sunday, and then the next Sunday, and then the next Sunday, and they get stuck in this routine of not meeting with God's people. And for all of these people then, it was never intended to be a permanent arrangement. It was just temporary. They told themselves that one day they would return, and what is more, they would return probably in a happier, better, restored condition. The time off church would do them good, would help them to recuperate, they thought to themselves. Well, I just want to tell you again this morning that 9 times out of 10, that's not the way it works. When those people return to church, if they ever return, they don't return feeling healthier and happier and refreshed and more full. No, like Naomi, they return feeling drained and withered and feeling empty. I mean, even like Naomi, they set out with the intention of looking for better things outside, for food, like Naomi does, outside of the people of God, they still return feeling more starved than when they set off. It's sort of ironic, isn't it? The famine has come to Israel, and yet Naomi and Elimelech, they leave Israel full, and they come back from their adventure looking for food empty, or Naomi does. And so again, I'm just setting this down as a warning to you. Don't go wandering. I think we can derive this lesson cautiously, yes, but correctly, I think we can derive this lesson from Naomi's experience in this passage. Don't go wandering from the people of God. You have been given so much by God in his church. Like Israel, you have been given brothers and sisters around you to encourage you and comfort you. You've been given the very word of God preached to you. You have been given special institutions like the Lord's Supper, which God willing we'll be celebrating next week. These things are there for your benefit. They are your spiritual food. And I'm not saying you should never change church. I'm not saying you should never go to a different church. But I am saying that, except for exceptional circumstances, we should never leave church, even if for a season, even if we only think it's for a period. Now, Naomi is a picture, I think, of what happens when a person does that, when they leave the people of God. Let's be taught by her trouble. So that's my first point this morning. We should be taught by her trouble. But then my second point, and it's this: we should be patient with her plight. We should be patient with her plight. And this is really now where I'm starting to qualify the stuff that I've just said. Let's imagine we meet a Christian, and this Christian is clearly in a bad way, and that at many levels of their lives, they are looking unhealthy. They're miserable. They're bitter. They're in a deprived condition. Well, we may well draw lessons from their example, mightn't we? We might look upon them as we looked upon Naomi. We might say to ourselves, well, look, behold, the dangers of wandering away from God. And to a point, that might be a fair lesson to derive from their lives. We might know things about their lifestyle, their spiritual condition, which allows us to come to those sorts of conclusions. To some extent, we might be right. They have been wandering from God. But here's the thing. Whatever lessons we might draw from that person, we need to proceed very cautiously. In particular, we must be very careful about what we say to that person or what we say about that person. Because if all we do is jump in and insist that their suffering is their own fault, and that clearly their sin must have been very, very bad, and we blame them for their own struggles, well, then I think we're acting very foolishly indeed. And people do that with Naomi in this passage. They look upon Naomi, and all they can say is, well, she's just sinned. The Lord's disciplining her. Her suffering, acute though it may be, horrible though it may be, it's well deserved. But I think if all we see in Naomi's pain is a bad example, then we're not being patient enough with her. Naomi, I think we can see in this passage, is suffering very badly. I want us to just begin by noticing the depths to which Naomi really has plunged in this passage. I mean, for one thing, she feels here like suffering defines her life. The people ask, is this Naomi in verse 19? The name Naomi probably meant sweet or pleasant. Perhaps she hasn't heard her own name spoken like that for a long time. Perhaps she's just heard herself referred to as mother or something like that by Ruth and Orpah. And suddenly then she hears this name again, Naomi, and it grates on her because sweet and pleasant is exactly how she doesn't feel right now. The irony of that name is painful to her. She'd actually prefer it if she was called something far more honest. Verse 20, do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, which means bitter, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with. So imagine people saying, oh, look who's coming down the street, it's bitter. Never guess who I saw in the marketplace today, bitter. Naomi's saying she would rather that. And so I think that really does reveal to us the depths of her plight. She's wanting to sort of redefine her life, her existence in terms of bitterness. Bitter is just who I am now. To call me Naomi, that feels wrong and absurd. And the moment I hear that word, I think, no, nothing to do with that anymore. That's not who I am. I'm bitter. For another thing, Naomi seems to have come close to losing sight of God's closeness. His intimacy with Naomi feels distant at this point. In verse 20, Naomi says, the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. At the end of verse 21, she says again, the Almighty has brought calamity upon me. When she's using those words, the Almighty, she's using the word for God in Hebrew, Shaddai. That word was not the personal name of God, like Yahweh, like the Lord. No, Shaddai, it conveyed no special intimacy, no comfort, no closeness. Shaddai was the word that treated God simply as the all-powerful ruler of the universe, terrifying and mysterious and dangerous, the Almighty, as it's translated here. Wasn't an incorrect word to use, but it was a word which emphasized his distance, his power, his strength, his mystery. And it's as if then, in her pain, Naomi has lost sight at times of the closeness of God. Yes, she does use the word Lord, that's true, but she uses Almighty to begin with and Almighty to end with. And so it's almost as if then, in her pain, God has simply become this terrible, powerful being out there and not close in here. Such is the depth of Naomi's plight. And then one other thing, it's as if Naomi feels mistreated by God. There's a spirit of protest in Naomi. She comes close to protesting against God. Look again at verse 20. In verse 20, in the middle of that verse, Naomi says, why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me? He's testified against me. Testified is a legal word. And really what she's saying is that she has been found guilty and she's being punished for something without actually knowing, without being informed what she's being punished for. She's saying, the Lord is punishing me for I know not what. He's testified against me. He's made these allegations. He's punishing me for something that he hasn't even revealed to me yet. And so there's almost this sort of this hint of allegation in her voice. She's almost making a complaint against the Lord, suggesting that she's been mistreated. Why are you forsaking me like this? She's complaining. These are the depths then to which Naomi has plunged. And perhaps then it would be very tempting for us to jump in at this point, to jump in and say, look, Naomi, that's the final straw. You have no right to complain against God. You have sinned, Naomi. You shouldn't have wandered off into Moab in the first place. However you might feel, you have no right to complain. You have sinned. You are suffering justly. Well, I'm not convinced that is the most helpful approach to take to this woman in this passage. Suffering, as we see here, is a profound thing at times. Often it's not easy for people to understand from the outside. You sort of have to be within suffering to understand just how profound it can become. I was reading a few weeks ago a book by C.S. Lewis called A Grief Observed, and Lewis's book is really just a series of reflections in the weeks and months which pass after his wife has died from cancer. He hasn't been married to her for very long, and really their marriage is just off to the start, and she dies. And Lewis is reflecting on this, and he's just expressing his most raw feelings about what's happened. And at times then what he writes in that book seems to be so raw, it makes very little sense for us on the outside. At times it's almost as if he's saying things which border on heresy. And people take these quotations from him, and I think they take them out of context and they make him look like he's saying things that he isn't. I don't think Lewis is being heretical in that book, but I do think that in the deep darkness to which he is plunged, his way of expressing himself has become extreme. But legitimately extreme. And Naomi, then, I think she's in a similar condition here. Actually, even that whole idea of complaining against God, I think by doing that, Naomi is actually in good company. We read Psalm 142 earlier, didn't we? What did David say at the beginning of that psalm? He said, I pour out my complaint before him. I tell my trouble before him. Now, David isn't sinning in writing those words. He's complaining to God, but he's not grumbling. He's not sinning. And we need to remember then that the Psalms, and Psalm 142 especially, is something that Jesus himself could have sung. I pour out my complaint. I state my case before the Almighty God and urge him to stop afflicting me. Jesus himself could echo those sentiments with real sincerity. My God, why have you forsaken me? He says on the cross. That is a sort of complaint, isn't it? Yes, he is obedient to his Father. Yes, he follows him to the very end. Yes, he always says, not my will, but yours be done. But nevertheless, there is a sense in which he is able to express that deep suffering in the form of a complaint. Why have you done this to me? It's interesting that even for Jesus, there seems to be a loss of the sense of the closeness of God. He says on that occasion, my God, why have you forsaken me? On other occasions, he calls his God Father, doesn't he? On the cross at times, he calls his God Father. He ends by committing his spirit to his Father. He begins by asking his Father to forgive those who are sinning against him. But in the heart of his crisis, he refers to his God only as his God. Why have you forsaken me? He's lost touch with the closeness of God. And so, on the basis of this, then, I'm saying that complaining, it's not necessarily wrong. And the depths of Naomi's tragedy here, they're not wrong, I think. I'm reluctant to say that what we see here is sinful. I think what we're seeing is the depth of her plight. And I think that the depth of her plight should at least encourage us to be patient with her, to respond to her situation cautiously. When the Bible teaches us, you see, that when we see a child of God in turmoil, in that level of suffering, especially when we don't know the facts of the case, especially when we can't point to obvious sins in their lives. The last thing we should try to do is identify some kind of sin. Sometimes there won't be a sin to identify. That's the point, isn't it? Made by the book of Job. The book of Job belongs to a group of books that we call the wisdom literature. And the wisdom literature, it's wonderfully diverse. On the one hand, you have a book like Proverbs, and Proverbs sets out these principles, and it tells us that a life of righteousness and diligence and honesty often leads to prosperity and blessing. And it tells us that sinfulness and laziness and dishonesty often results in poverty and pain and destruction. But then you have a book like Job. And if you thought Proverbs was the full picture, then Job sort of throws a spanner in the works, doesn't it? It makes you realise that you can't take Proverbs and apply it blanket to the whole of life. What you see in Job is that sometimes children of God suffer terribly, even when they've lived blameless lives. And yes, I think Naomi, she probably isn't blameless in this case. Her sin probably does contribute to her misery. But you see, even then, I think, even when we see a believer who we can say has committed certain sins, even then, it doesn't mean we should be able to rush in and start sort of reeling off a big list of things that person has done. Because at the end of the day, I think suffering is too profound, too deep, too mysterious to treat simplistically like that. We need to be patient with sufferers. There's a book written in the 1970s by quite a well-known man. It was written about Christian counselling, and some of the other books that this man has written were very good, very helpful. And even this book on counselling has a fair share of wisdom in it. But there's also a lot of foolishness in that book. And basically the author thought then, his basic approach was that when we see someone who is in a mentally disturbed and confused situation, most of the time, he says, there's a problem with sin. So for instance, this is what he writes about someone who's very depressed. He says, in suicidal cases, when a client has such a low opinion of himself that he thinks the world would be better without him, it only hurts to deny that his low estimate is valid. Counsellors should acknowledge that he probably is right about the present worthlessness of his life and should attempt to discover how bad he has been. Well, when I read the scriptures, I can't help but think that that author is writing there in a way which is profoundly irresponsible and foolish and dangerous. He writes like a man who has only witnessed these things from the outside. He hasn't felt the full weightiness of what he's writing about. I mean, how would that man have responded to a case like Job? Job is a man who cursed the day of his birth. He wanted to die, and yet surely the whole problem with Job's situation were that his counsellors were trying to discover how bad he'd been. If Job's life had been hell before his counsellors opened their mouths, it became even more hellish when they did. Chapter after chapter of that book, those counsellors eloquently try to describe Job's problems. They apply all sorts of wisdom to the situation. And yet Job's condition just gets worse and worse. And Job finds himself spiraling deeper and deeper into painful confusion, into this theological mess, until it reaches the point where God himself has to interrupt the whole affair and provide a bit of perspective. Job's distress is only relieved when God gives him a sight of the immensity of God himself. And so I return then to Naomi and to any other Christian who is suffering like her out there. Perhaps that's you. Yes, we might look at certain Christians at times and privately learn lessons. That might be appropriate from time to time, but we always must be patient with the plight of our brothers and sisters. Suffering can be an awful, awful thing, a profound thing. And unless you're in the throes of it, it's probably best to presume that you underestimate it. The moment you're tempted to dive in and start explaining things and blaming things and trying to give clever theological answers, I advise you, slow down, be cautious, be patient. So how do we respond to Naomi's return? Well, we should be taught by her trouble, but we should be patient with her plight. And then thirdly and finally, more briefly, we should rejoice at her return. We should rejoice at her return. Ultimately, the return to Bethlehem is the big theme of this passage. It's a word, actually, which literally begins the passage and ends it. So chapter 1, verse 6, you see there that then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return to the country of Moab. And then you turn back, turn to the end of the passage, down to verse 22, summary statement, and so Naomi returned. It's encapsulating the whole theme here. Returning is the big theme here. And whatever we might think then of Naomi's past mistakes or present struggles, that theme alone, the return of the wanderer, should put a smile on our faces. As indeed it seems it puts a smile on the faces of the locals. In the middle of verse 19, it says there that the whole town was stirred because of them. Actually, the word stir is the Hebrew word hum. It's a bit like our word hum. The word itself sounds like the thing it's trying to describe. The whole town is humming. And that's a very positive, happy kind of humming, happy kind of stirring, probably. It's the same word which is used in 1 Kings chapter 1, when Solomon undergoes his coronation, and there's this rejoicing in the air, the stirring, the humming. I think that's the same idea here. There's a spirit of rejoicing at Naomi returning to the village. And surely that's natural, isn't it? That's the kind of response you'd expect Naomi to get. She's returning to her own people. When Hamas returned certain hostages back to Israel last week, there was legitimate rejoicing, because to receive back one of your own is a naturally happy thing. And it is here for the villagers, I think, and it should be like that for us as well. To welcome wanderers back through our doors into our churches is a cause for rejoicing. And it may well be that at some point in the future, someone will walk through our doors, someone that you haven't seen for a very long time. Someone you thought you might never see in church again. And they might come in feeling like Naomi does, feeling empty, feeling like they've got their tail between their legs. Well, if that ever happens, let's make sure that we are smiling when they enter. Let's welcome them with open arms. Let's make them feel very, very welcome. Let's rejoice at their return. They are family. They're back again. That's a happy thing. As I wrap up, let me just observe just two further things in this text. So there are two things here which really do, I think, in a special way, enhance this rejoicing in this passage. There are two things which really do lighten up this dark passage in a profound way. There are two things which make this return to Bethlehem happier than most returns. The first is this, that this return involves a Gentile. There's part of this passage which baffles commentators. If you look at verse 22, it says there, "So Naomi returned, and Ruth, the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, comma, who returned from the country of Moab," referring to Ruth. The verse is saying that Ruth returned from the country of Moab. And the reason that commentators are confused is because, well, in the Hebrew, return just means return, to turn your back on something, to come back to something. And it raises the question then, how can Ruth return from the country of Moab when she is actually a Moabite? How can she return to Bethlehem if she's never been to Bethlehem in the first place? That's the question people struggle over. And I don't have a concrete answer to that question, but I think there's a credible one. See, I think possibly the narrator is hinting that while Ruth might still be a Moabite, in going to Israel, she is doing the same thing that Naomi is doing. She is also, in her own way, a wanderer coming back to her true homeland. She is also returning, as it were, to the place where she truly belongs. Just as Naomi the Israelite is returning from a distant land and back to her true God, So Ruth the Gentile is returning from a distant land and back to her true God. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 talks about God reconciling the world to himself. The idea is that he is bringing the world back to himself. What has become estranged from him, alienated from him, is now being returned back to him, brought back to the one to whom it belongs. And 2 Corinthians, of course, is talking about the age in which we live, the gospel age, our own age. But when people from every tribe and every tongue and every nation are reconciled, brought back to God. But here in the book of Ruth, we see it beginning to happen already, don't we? Ruth is truly one of God's enemies. She is estranged from him. She is locked away in this foreign country, living under idolatry. And now, as it were, she is returning back to where she belongs, returning to her true home, returning to her true God. And so she might look like just some awkward Moabite accessory tagging along behind Naomi, not really mentioned much in the passage at all, but she is actually a precious child of God returning to his arms. So that's the first thing that is particularly happy in this passage. And then finally, one more thing which makes this a particularly happy passage. The return takes place at harvest. The return takes place at harvest. The end of verse 22. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. Well, what's the big deal there? It's just a piece of factual information. Well, no, it's providing us with some closure to the whole theme of famine which we began with. Now we have the proof. The famine is over. The narrator is giving us the first glimpse of the very thing that Naomi set out for in the first place. Bread. As I said last time, the lechem has returned to Bethlehem. The bread has returned to the house of bread, literally. It wasn't just rumours. The famine is actually over. The harvest has begun. We now see it with our eyes. And again, you might just think, well, it's just a couple of sentences to wrap things up. But you see, those sentences get to the heart of what this whole book is all about. It's all about the journey from grimness to blessing. That's what the whole of the book of Ruth is about. And we've finally got our sight of that blessing. The barley is growing in the fields. Harvest is coming. Yes, Naomi, she enters Bethlehem feeling poor, feeling empty, hungry, feeling old. She doesn't even feel like Naomi anymore. She feels like Mara. She feels bitter. But Naomi, she has no idea. Not long from now, her old name, Naomi, sweetness, will feel more appropriate than she could possibly imagine. She has returned to the breadbasket. She's about to be filled in ways she cannot possibly imagine. Blessing is coming to Naomi and Ruth. And I'll just end with this application. Naomi's situation is not too different from our own, is it really? It might be that your vision has become obscured with your present struggles, grief and emptiness and weakness. You might feel like for yourself life is more bitter now than sweet. Well, I just want to remind you from this passage, take heart. You too have returned. You, like Ruth, have been brought back to your true God. You have been brought, as it were, into the house of blessing. And you too then stand at the cusp of wonderful things, better blessings than you could possibly imagine. And one day, very shortly, your Lord is going to return, and you will see him with your eyes, and the grave will have no hold over you, and your body will be strong and beautiful, and the world will be filled with the praise of God's name. You're just like Naomi. You have no idea how happy it will be, and it's just around the corner. So I encourage you then, take heart, trust in God. This is the God who brings blessing out of grimness. And if you are in him this morning, if you are trusting in him, if he is your God, then let me tell you, he will bring blessing into your life. And that is sure, the Lord will return and he will restore this world. Amen.